Well, good morning. It's Jeff Wine, host of The Car Show here on Sun Sounds Radio. Folks, once again, we have an action-packed show for you today. We're going to catch you up on the latest and greatest of the world of the automobile. Well, NASCAR kicked off their preseason run last weekend at Bowman Gray Stadium. We'll talk a little bit about that. And a week from today, the running of the Daytona 500, the Great American Race. So we'll have a little bit of update on that. Got a cool story about a 1987 Woody. Cool story about a guy who decided he wasn't going to trade for a Dodge 880. We'll catch you up on what's going on with next weekend's running of the Fountain Hills Car Show. A little cool story about the Prescott Car Club. And of course, it wouldn't be the car show without a little prices on our gas and what's going on with Car Talk. Folks, fasten those seatbelts nice and tight. It's going to be a fast ride on the Car Show. Well, from the pages of one of my favorite magazines, Old Cars, the title of this article is Saved from the Salvage Yard. A 1987 Town and Country is a modern rarity. Well, William Harris's 1987 LeBaron Town and Country was only 24 years old when he saw it as it was worth saving. One of the newest cars on the AACA Fall Meet show floor at the Hershey, Pennsylvania show, when he spotted it. I rescued it from a salvage yard, Harris said, who lives in Pennsylvania, because the story was on the front page of the newspaper when it got hit in the front end. Even years later, seeing such a relative recent car at a major car show can be jarring in some ways. But the hobby doesn't stand still, with plenty of longtime collectors who can recall similar experiences when younger cars have grown into older cars and become objects of preservation or restoration. Harris's LeBaron was a good choice for several reasons. Not the least of is the history, which dates back before we started thinking about Chryslers as front-wheel drive and four-cylinder vehicles. Well, the K-Car comes to the rescue. By late 70s, the Chrysler Corporation was facing serious problems enough that it saw a possible total collapse. There was a feeling in some quarters that it would be allowed to collapse and then disappear. But there was some potential. At least one thing was happening. Dodge and the Plymouth divisions had recently launched the Omni and the Horizon, and that was in retrospect in 1978. They were compared to many of their predecessors. The 99-inch wheelbase front-wheel drive hatchbacks were good for an honest 30 miles per gallon. Now, Dodge then added the 02, 024, and the Plymouth TC3 following year with a sporty hatchbacks to the boxy four-door Omni and Horizon hatchbacks. But on a broader scale, the front-wheel drive was becoming the future of Chrysler. Primarily, it needed to increase those tightly held federal fuel economy mandates with the design benefits that had better traction in poor driving conditions and be able to be adapted to different platforms. In 1981, the concept compact K-Cars, Dodge Aries, and the Plymouth Reliant arrived on the showroom floors while the larger, older V8 models still had some life left in the various Chrysler divisions. Now, the K-Cars were initially sold as station wagons, two-door and four-door sedans. The 2.2-liter overhead cam four-cylinder engine produced a whopping 84 horsepower, but not a bad trade-off for 25 miles in the city and 41 on the highway. Now, Lee Iacocca, who had become Chrysler's president in November of 1978, wrote in his 1984 autobiography that the K-Car's fuel economy topped those of the General Motors comparable X-Cars. He also pointed out that that Motor Trend named the Reliant and the Aries Cars of the Year in 1981, 3 years after bestowing the same recognition on the Omni and the Horizon. Now, the K-Cars faced some of their share of problems, most notably a sense that the business was rather the cars themselves. Iacocca observed that the timing coincided with some of Chrysler's worst financial days. During our darkest days, he wrote, the promise of the K-Cars always was the light at the end of the tunnel. And for a couple years, the prospect of an American-made, fuel-efficient, front-wheel drive car was just about all we had to offer. Throughout the congressional hearings during the endless negotiations with the banks, and the expectation was the K-Car is what got us through. Like the Omni and the Horizon, the K-Car sold solidly and was successful and went on to serve as a platform that Iacocca described as virtually every other car we had. His list of examples would be the LeBaron, the 1982 Chrysler version, whose namesake had come from the midsize model in 1977. Now, this LeBaron had very, very little to do with its predecessor. It also had the 2.2-liter engine and still only making 84 horsepower. Now, before the year was out, Chrysler decided that these practical cars were important, but fun shouldn't be neglected either. LeBaron came out as the first American production convertible since 1976's Cadillac Eldorado. It naturally received attention. Less noticed was the new LeBaron that also carried the old name, the Town and Country Station Wagon. Now, like the original, it was a Woody, although the last Chrysler wearing real wood had been built in 1950. But the name had been seen as an upscale wagon in 1941 with its unusual barrel styling. After the short 1942 model year, it returned online with the high-end convertibles and sedans in 1946 into the first series in 1949 and then moved into the second series as a convertible and became a coupe in 1950. Even though the name was applied to both the wood bodies and the steel wagons at the same year, the name was too good to let go. By 1978, it was used in the wagon, the midsize LeBaron line, when LeBaron moved into the compact 1982, the Town and Country went with it. At a whopping $9,425, the 1982 Town and Country was the costliest model in the group, but $2,200 below the convertible and $4,500 under the top medallion convertible for the equivalent of $23,000 today. The Town and Country buyer bought the 92 2.6-liter Ford, which was actually a Mitsubishi engine using its silent shaft technology for smoother performance. It was an automatic with automatic transmission, but also air conditioning, power windows, AM/FM radio, and other equipment that we would take for granted in modern cars were still an option. Its 7,809 sales placed it above the base model convertible, but it was enough to ensure its return. Over the next few years, the LeBaron added several new models looking like the 1982 design that continued until 1988. The original angle styling gradually grew dated, and that might explain how Harris ended up in the accident that he was able to afford to buy this. Yeah, the guy who owned it was traveling back and forth to work with it, Harris explained, and he got hit at a traffic light, very lightly, and they just parked it. I found it and drove it because I thought it was a little bit different. Now, repairing even the minor damage had presented some problems for its owner, but Harris recognized its possibilities. Yeah, when I saw it, I recalled, I said, I have two of those station wagons in the yard, and they're probably pretty similar to this. I think I could fix this. So we bought it with the intent in mind that we would fix it and drive it, and we just put a hood and a header in it, and the guy, well, he couldn't find parts, but we did. Now, Harris had the advantage there. He owns several LeBaron convertibles, an example, some of the wagons. He also knows that the fuel-injected 2.5-liter Ford in his car probably wasn't driven as hard as it could have been if it had the turbocharged version. Still, this wasn't a Sunday car, given the odometer showed over 100,000 miles, but it had air conditioning, cruise control, and an automatic, and still on the road regularly these days. Yeah, and people who see it, they don't really recognize it. Yeah, the only people who really understand it are the Chrysler fanatics, and they knew what the car is. Others can identify it, who said, I think their grandmother or someone else in the family had a car like that. Now, Harris said, I like different stuff. I have a lot of different stuff. It's original, and it's unique, and you don't see it on the road anymore. Well, this is definitely an example of the badging and the vinyl siding on these cars to make them look like a true Woody. But I'm looking at the little car right now, and it's got a luggage rack, and it's kind of a beige-ish, yellowish, creamy color, and the car looks in great condition. So certainly not a car that you would think you would see at the car shows with the other Camaros and Mustangs and 55 Chevrolets and those things. But the reality is that those cars are now becoming collectors, and a guy who has a 1984 Mustang, I'm right there with him. Well, in old cars, there's also a little section called Club Eclipse. And one of our local clubs got mentioned in this one. Prescott Club is going strong after 51 years. Well, every car club has its own special tale. And the Prescott Antique Auto Club has a special provenance according to a recent entry in the annual Golden Quill Awards, proudly sharing the story of by an active promoter, Charles O. Thompson, ND, of Chino Valley, and the club president is Mike Odie. After 51 years of operation, the club claims it has more than 200 members and a large annual car show at Watkins Lake in early August. We support local charities and fund several scholarships each year. Some of the credits of the club's active charter goes to Charlotte Hall, who started preserving Prescott's buildings and artifacts. She also owned a Durant Star. She also happened to be with the club when they took on its restoration as an early project. The project became a purposeful binding element as the club's friendship and strengthening their resolve, and indeed, the happy that the clubs are a wholesome challenge that equates to pride and club growth. Then the club also took up the task to restore the first ladder fire truck in Prescott and currently finishing up Old Dodge, which is known as School Bus Number 1. So the Prescott Car Club, the Prescott Antique Auto Club, is going strong up in Prescott, Arizona. Now, we gave a brief description of this last weekend, but next weekend, February 15th, the Concours in the Hills takes place. It's the 11th annual Phoenix Children's Hospital Concours in the Hills, known as the Greatest Car Show on Grass. It's going to take place at the Fountain Hills Park, and that's going to be from 10 a.m. until 3 p.m. There's going to be a ton of cool cars out there to see, some military displays, exotic cars, race cars, and folks, it's absolutely free to get into. So if you're looking for something fun to do next weekend, next Saturday, check out the Fountain Hills Car Show. It's 10 a.m. until 3 p.m. Well, a great story from the editor of Old Cars, and his name is Angelo Van Bogen, and the story talks about dodging a custom 880. Well, it still amazes me that after 25 years at working at Old Cars magazine, the stories from the contributors and the readers bring back memories of automotive experiences that somehow I'd forgotten. And the latest example of Al Rogers' 1961 Dodge Dart Pioneer story in this issue reminded me of a trade that I almost made with a 1963 Dodge Custom 880 and my 1969 Buick. Now, back in the mid-90s, I was driving a 1969 Buick Skylark Custom two-door hardtop back and forth to high school and then to college. As many readers may recall of my past writings about the green Skylark, I didn't immediately fall in love with the car. Its sweeping styling of the 68 and 69 generation of the Skylark, especially in the curved body lines, rear bumper, and the love-it-or-hate-it look, in my experience, most people are in the hate it category. I too, and still until I owned it for a while and having a chance to really study the car's design elements, which emulate the natural curvature of a lark, spreading with its wings spreading open, coupled with an affinity for Stevie Nicks and the Fleetwood Mac song Rhiannon, which Rhiannon compares herself to a Skylark, I came to appreciate the Buick Skylark, but I digress. During my Skylark driving years, my Mopar buddy dragged a big 1963 Dodge Custom 880 two-door hardtop. Knowing that the Custom 880 was plus size or two plus size for him, he liked smaller muscle cars from which he could maximize the horsepower, darts, dusters, roadrunners, and the like. I contemplated making the prospect of a trade, my duster-sized Skylark, for his Dodge 880. Now, to be honest, I had never seen a 1963 Custom 880 before that car. My friend explained that it was a stopgap model based on a Chrysler body. The Custom 880 was intended to satisfy Dodge's need for a traditional full-size car as they introduced smaller models. The wacky grille in the 1962 Polara 500 and then the 1963 330, 440 and the Polara models. And then in 1963, they were somewhere between an intermediate and a full size. Now, between the 1963 Customs airy greenhouse size and the 1962 body, well, it came about the same time as the Chrysler 300. I was smitten with the look of my friend's latest find. However, all its white paint was flat and distressed. The interior needed to be reupholstered. Although it ran, it really wasn't a good replacement for my Buick Daily Driver, and I hadn't yet come to that realization. Now, before I could suggest it, my friend offered to trade my Skylark for the 880. Since my parents held the title on my Skylark, I ran home and told them about the exciting trade option. I explained the condition to them of the 880 to my parents. It was clear by my parents' expression that they were not nearly as enthusiastic about the idea as I was. Besides the lesser condition of the custom 880, they were concerned about finding parts for a 35-year-old Dodge would be more difficult than finding parts for the 30-year-old Buick. And then feeding gas to the larger custom 880 would make a big dent in my budget than the Skylark was already making. Deflated, I succumbed to their wisdom and declined the trade. A year or two later, my parents were proven correct when I ended up selling the Skylark and buying a more fuel-efficient modern car for my college commute. In retrospect, I'm glad that the Dodge for the Buick trade didn't work out. I had more time with the Skylark and to further develop my appreciation for it. And now the custom 880 is a memory that has rekindled. I feel a strong urge to study the car further. Hopefully, there are more stories in old cars and it will help rekindle your memories about the same way you continue to do them for me. Yeah, it's really interesting that Skylark, my friend Mark, had one when we were in high school. And I remember the car distinctly. And I was one of those guys that was definitely part of that. Yeah, I hated the styling too. Well, let's talk a little motorsports news from the pages of the Indy Star. The headline reads, IndyCar expects to land 3 national Super Bowl commercials worth more than $30 million in exposure. Well, IndyCar has landed an unprecedented marketing boost from its exclusive media rights with its partner Fox for the upcoming Super Bowl after nearly a decade of occasional regional booking for Super Bowl ads to help build hype for the Indy 500. Fox expects to run all 3 of its new IndyCar commercials, including the debut of a 45-second promotional spot around Pato O'Ward during today's Super Bowl. In addition, the first 2 spots featuring Fox's IndyCar promotional and campaign with back-to-back winners Joseph Newgarden and series champion Alex Palou are expected to appear sometime during Fox's 5.5 hours of coverage. The airtime IndyCar is landing its new unprecedented media rights partner worth $30 million, a figure that far exceeds IndyCar's budget and its media rights, according to USA Today. A current spot is selling for somewhere between $7 and $8 million, and the pre-game ads are supposed to sell for $4.5 million. So this is a huge deal, folks, for us IndyCar fans. They rekindled the NASCAR deal last year, where before Fox had the first half of the season, NBC had the second half. Well, they've now created room for adding Amazon Prime in covering the NASCAR series, as well as TNT. That in itself cut the number of races that Fox has. Fox has been doing very little to promote their running of the Daytona 500 this year. So all the NASCAR fans are up in arms on social media about where's the promotion for NASCAR and the Daytona 500. And of course, as being an IndyCar fan, I just kind of chuckle. So big deal, big news, IndyCar spots and promos running in today's Super Bowl. Well, last week, NASCAR ran their Clash event. Now, this race used to be a part of Speed Week down at Daytona for the Daytona 500. But a couple years ago, they moved it out to the LA Coliseum. I actually went to that first race where they built a quarter-mile racetrack inside the Los Angeles Coliseum. Well, this year, they took it to the historic Bowman Gray quarter-mile racetrack in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And the event was a huge success. And the headline reads, Bowman Gray was a much improved event from the Coliseum. Well, Bowman Gray's stadium's hosting the Clash received the seal of approval from the race winner, Chase Elliott. Now, Elliott admitted his bias after winning the Sunday night exhibition race, calling it a special moment. After starting from the pole, Elliott led a race-high 170 of the 200 laps in his Hendrick's Motorsport Chevrolet and made the winning pass on Denny Hamlin on lap 126. Quote, it seems like a success, Elliott said. I know it's always been tough from a winner's perspective when everything goes your way, but it seemed like the track was very racy, although the whole deal has been improved for the last couple years for sure. Now, the decision to make this run this race at Bowman Gray is because Bowman Gray has been the historic track that has been the home of running Saturday night racing for NASCAR's Grassroots Series, and they decided that after 3 years in Los Angeles, they felt they wanted to do a small track in what would be considered NASCAR country. So I think it's been a great win, and I watched the event itself, and I thought the racing was good. I'm not a huge fan of those short tracks with these big cars, but overall it was a great race, and I think Bowman Gray will be back next year for the Clash. Well, and some more NASCAR news, folks. The Daytona 500 is a week from today, but next week we've got all the support events and support races and practice and qualifying. So I'm going to kind of give you a big rundown of Wednesday through Sunday of next week if you want to catch some NASCAR action. So practice, the first practice for the Daytona 500 is going to be on Fox Sports 1, and that's going to be on Wednesday the 12th, and that is going to start at 8 a.m. local time. There's also going to be qualifying for the Daytona 500, and that's single qualifying laps, and that's going to start at 6:15, and that's going to be on Fox Sports 1 as well, and that's on Wednesday the 12th. Moving to Thursday the 13th, we have practice for the Craftsman Truck Series. That's going to be at 3:05, and that's going to be on Fox Sports 1 as well. Then we have the duels at Daytona. This is how, besides the two fastest cars in qualifying, the rest of the folks have to race their way in. So we have the duels at Daytona, which start at 5 p.m., and that's going to be on Fox Sports 1, and there are two different races that evening. All right, now we're moving on to Friday the 14th, Valentine's Day. Don't forget to get your very special person a card and a nice little gift. We have qualifying for the Craftsman Truck Series at 1 o'clock that day on Fox Sports 1. We have practice for the Xfinity Series on the CW. We have a NASCAR, that's going to be at 2:30. We have a practice for the Cup Series on Fox Sports 1, and that's going to be at 3:30. And then we have the Fresh from Florida 250, the Craftsman Truck Series race, and that will be at 5:30 on Fox Sports 1. So Fox Sports 1 and the CW are your home for the preliminaries. Now we move to Saturday the 15th. At 10 o'clock, you're going to have the ARCA 200, which is another support race. That will be on Fox Broadcast TV. You can also catch the United Rentals 300, and that's going to be at 3 o'clock, and that's going to be on the CW. Now we move to race day. Sunday the 16th, the Daytona 500 will run at 12:30 local time, and that will be on Fox Broadcast as well. So now, well, and of course, next week, we will have some more preliminary information. We'll talk about the qualifying order and the results from the twin qualifiers. There's a lot of cars trying to make the race, and we'll see what happens with four-time Indy 500 winner Elio Castroneves trying to make his first Daytona 500. Well, time to talk gas prices with our friends over at AAA. Right now, the average gas price in the United States is $3.13. Average gas price here in Arizona is $3.27, New Mexico $2.94, Utah $3.05, Colorado $2.99, California $4.60, and our friends in Nevada are paying an average of $3.75. All right, let's see what's going on here in Metro Phoenix with our gas prices. Well, the cheapest fuel right now in the state is at the Love's Travel Stop in Eloy, once again at $2.59 a gallon. The Circle K is at $2.59 in Eloy as well. The 76 station in Casa Grande at $2.67. And the Pilot in Eloy at $2.69. Oh, and the Arco station in Bullhead at $2.69. Yeah, definitely gas prices have been climbing here in the metro. Right now, the least expensive gas is at the Fry's station on 43rd and McDowell, West McDowell, and that's $2.84. Circle K on Bell Road and 98th Avenue at $2.85. Tempe, the Costco on Elliott is at $2.93, and the Costco on 79th Avenue is at $2.99. And I know I paid $2.99 a gallon last week at the Costco on 33rd Avenue and Grand. So gas prices are definitely sneaking up right now here in Metro Phoenix. We've come to that time of the show. Time for a little car talk. Dear Car Talk, I over-tightened a lug nut on an alloy wheel. It seemed to have pushed right through the alloy and up against the metal on the other side. Is there a fix for this? The rest of the lug nuts are okay, and that's from Perry. Yes, not to worry, Perry. There's a very easy fix. It's called a new wheel. You've ruined the old one, and you might want to back off on those bicep curls a little bit. It's not easy to tighten a wheel nut to the point where it punctures right through the rim. You don't really see that every day. Now, I can think of three explanations of why this might have happened. One, it's a very old car, and the wheels are severely corroded. In that case, you don't need a new wheel. You might need a whole set of them. The other possibility is you were using a torque wrench for the first time in your life, and you set it on 4,000 pounds. I'd strongly encourage you to read the owner's manual before trying that again. Maybe you were using an air wrench, or maybe you were trying to loosen the nut and you were turning it the wrong way. You didn't notice it until it was too late. In that case, repeat after me, lefty loosey, righty tighty. Now, don't feel bad. I actually did something many, many decades ago when cars actually had left-hand threads on the left side of the car to prevent the centrifugal force from loosening them as you drove. Now, one night I tried to change a flat. No matter how hard I tried, I literally stood on the lug wrench. I couldn't seem to loosen the nuts, so I gave up and walked home. I realized the next day the unusual left-handed threads when I came back the next morning and I saw it in daylight. There was an L on the marking of the end of the bolt. Now, in any case, right now, that wheel is trash. You have five lugs to hold the car on the wheel on the car. Need to think about that. There are tremendous forces that are trying to separate that wheel from the car. Going around a corner at 45 miles an hour in a 3,000 or 4,000-pound vehicle? So it's not safe just to make do with four lug nuts. As my wife suggests, I try it. Since you've tightened the shinola out of that wheel nut, you probably have stretched and possibly damaged the bolt as well. And likely the other four if you were equally exuberant with those. So as long as they're not corroded, you might be able to get away with just one new wheel. But I would certainly replace all five lug nuts and all the lug bolts to be safe. Then you'll be good to go, Perry. Yeah, this stuff happens all the time. It's people over-tightening and then also sometimes people not tightening these things enough. And there gets to be just a slight little wobble in the wheel and that kind of roots out the opening on the wheel itself, and that could cause damage. But certainly over-tightening a wheel lug nut could absolutely cause this damage. And people, well, they do it all the time. Well, folks, we've reached that time. It's time for the end of the car show. Thanks for listening. We'll meet you back again on the radio next Sunday, and you're listening to Sun Sounds Radio of Arizona.